Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. We're live, as it were, in sunny San Diego, California, here from the Firehouse World Show. Brother Wilbur and I have been out here since Monday of this week, and before we start out today's show, I want to just recognize a few folks. One, I want to send out our best wishes and speedy and safe recovery to Harvey Eisner from the magazine. And secondly, to the hosts that we've had over the course of the last couple days from the San Diego Fire Rescue Department, in particular, Captain Kevin Esther, who manages the apparatus specifications and the resources up in the San Diego fire shops. Captain Esther really went above and beyond to extend himself to show some courtesies to Michael and myself during the course of the week, gave us a firsthand tour of some of the stations and the apparatus in the shops, and we greatly appreciate that. So here's today's rundown. Mike's going to give you an update about what's going on with the seatbelt initiative as a result of some activities that have been happening over the course of the last couple of months with that. We're then going to shift into and talk about the recent incident in the city of Boston, where they had some aerial ladder incident and what the results of that were. During some of the course of the programs that were offered during this past week out here at Firehouse World in San Diego, there was a lot of pretty heavy discussion on quints and what Mike and I individually thought about them. But more importantly, if you do own one, what do you do once you have it and you have to try to operate it and become effective on the fire ground? So we're going to spend a little bit of time talking about that. And then we're going to get into some responding back to some questions that have been sent in to firehouse.com as a result of our previous webcast, as well as Mike's recent podcast on emergency vehicle operations. So, Mike, why don't you update us here on what's going on with the seatbelt initiative and some things that maybe the people out there that might be listening can help you out and the folks that are looking to make our lives a little bit safer by getting belts that actually do work.
Hey, Tom. Good afternoon, everybody. Be more than happy to do that. The seatbelt initiative is moving along at an unbelievably rapid pace. It just seems unbelievable that we, knock on wood, haven't had any problems, and we've been moving forward. We have acquired over $250,000 in funding for the pilot study program that we are initiating. Total Contact, a group who actually does body scans for burn victims to make pressure-sensitive garments, have taken this project on, and in conjunction with the National Fallen Firefighters, the International Association of Fire Chiefs and their Health, Safety, and Survival Section, and also NIOSH, are undertaking this pilot study as partners. We have also partnered with the U.S. Air Force and some PhDs there, along with General Dynamics, the owner of the body scanner. We are entering into now an anthropometric study. Anthropology, as it's called, didn't even know that word before we started out on this venture, is the measuring of firefighters via body scan. What we hope to accomplish in the short term are better seats with more rooms, better, newer seat belts that will be easy to use for everybody. Perhaps it'll have an effect on SCBA's SCBA bracketry and the inside of the cabs as a whole. In the long term, we hope to have an effect on literally everything in the fire service, from spacing and aerial ladder rungs and portable ladder rungs to grab rails on the apparatus to steps to breathing apparatus and straps and bunker clothing, whether it be pants, coats, gloves. So we have a lot that's going to go on and affect us in a positive way as far as firefighter safety.
Mike, when you talk about these body scans, just can you, what exactly is that? It sounds to me like it's something like you go through a TSA inspection when you're trying to get through the airport. What's exactly going to be involved with that?
It's almost pretty similar. You stand in a spot, and part of the methodology is being worked out now, but what we hope to accomplish is to have a firefighter in shorts that are going to be provided and put some white dots on you that help gather data. The scanner is four posts that you're surrounded, and the scanning mechanism goes down. It's painless. It doesn't take very long, but we hope to get five scans on each firefighter, one in the shorts, one in a work duty uniform standing, one in a work duty uniform sitting, one in bunker gear standing, and then one in bunker gear sitting. Our goal is to do 180 firefighters in this first round. This project has a completion date with deliverables in October of this year, at what point we hope that there is going to be a $1 million+ grant that we're going to get through NIOSH, and NIOSH is going to continue on with this, and we're going to scan over 1,300 firefighters and also do a range of motion study and an energy study to determine at what point firefighters get tired and worn out and could be prone to injury, along with many other facets of firefighting. What we are looking for out there in our listening audience are specific firefighters. In order to get a good cross-section of the firefighting population, we are looking for minority firefighters to take part in a study. Right now, we have over 500 firefighters that have signed up to help us, but those numbers don't truly represent the diversity which is in the fire service right now.
So in other words, what you're telling me is you're not just trying to measure guys out of ladder companies in New York and trying to like sway the statistics here. We really want to try to get a good cross section. Kind of just maybe be looking like the high school basketball team. You can't all recruit the 6'5" guys. It's going to be the short guys, the medium-sized folks, the tall folks, the thin folks, and the folks that are not so thin.
Right, exactly. And also, we need Asian firefighters, male and female. We need Hispanic firefighters, male and female. We need African-American firefighters that are male and female as well. And there'll be links provided at the bottom of our podcast here. One will be to Firefighters Close Calls, also firehouse.com, Total Contact and Emergency Vehicle Response, and you can all link up and fill out the information and become part of really what's going to end up being a worthwhile study and will have an impact on firefighter safety for decades to come.
All right, Mike, also recently attended an apparatus symposium down at sponsored by FDSOA down in Orlando, Florida, and there was a seminal, one of the presentations was put on by Roger LaCour, one of the principal engineers out of Pierce Manufacturing, and it appears that there's also a parallel initiative, but maybe not as in doing this body scan portion, where they were looking to get actual measurements of firefighters in bunker gear, both standing and sitting. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that as to what that program entails?
Yeah, that's actually where we started out. Roger LaCour is an engineer with Pierce Manufacturing. He is also a member of the Fire Apparatus Manufacturers Association, as well as a member of the NFPA 1901 Committee. Roger's an engineer, and he's really quite brilliant, and came up with a methodology to physically take tape measures and measure firefighters. And that's where this initiative actually started. And to date, we have been able to gather over 500 firefighter measurements. Again, we will have links available to those places, particularly emergencyvehiclerespondence.com, where you can learn how to actually measure your firefighters by hand with measuring tapes that will help that initial study. This is actually three studies. We started out measuring people physically, and then we had the good fortune to be able to network and run into Jen Whitestone from Total Contact, who had access to the methodology and to the body scanner, which can then further that research And then finally that took us to NIOSH headquarters in Morgantown, West Virginia, where we met a PhD by the name of Dr. Hanway, who has a body scanner there as well, along with one at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that's going to pick the ball up and actually continue with the big NIOSH study that's going to be a multi-year, multi-million dollar study. And nothing like this in the fire service has ever been done before.
Mike, it's a lot of good stuff. I mean, just a little background is the progress we made just within the last 11 and a half months is pretty incredible. It was about a year ago when Mike and I were out in the San Diego Firehouse World Show, and we've been very blessed to be asked to come back for a succeeding year, where there was a lot of discussion or frankly, after-show buzz about the NFPA coming forth with a standard starting out of the 1901 committee that would recommend or require in the standard that SCBAs of any description be physically removed from the cab and carried elsewhere. And that's, as I recall, that's kind of like where we got started, just talking about, well, maybe what we've always envisioned the physical size of the firefighter to be and how these seats have been designed, or even going to where the standard says you're going to allow 200 pounds per firefighter fully bunkered out when you're applying that to the carrying capacity of the crew compartment versus the gross axle weight ratings on the front and the rear, that maybe we just kind of need to start all over and just rethink some of the process here.
Well, that's absolutely correct, Tom. Much of what's been done in the fire service in the past has been little more than just an educated guess. Very little equipment and very little that's provided to the fire service has actually any scientific backing whatsoever. And it became apparent after Roger started measuring, and in the first 60 measurements that were taken, 50 from the Charlotte, North Carolina Fire Department and 10 from the LA City Fire Department, it became apparent that we had a severe problem. In those early measurements, and of course it's nothing that you can, it's not dependent on the whole study, but just those early results told us that four firefighters sitting four across in the back of a custom cab apparatus just simply don't fit. In the 95th percentile group, we found that it would require a minimum of 95 inches with four firefighters shoulder-to-shoulder in bunker gear, and the standard American custom cab only had 89 inches. So right away, we had a problem. In that, it actually helped propel this to some degree because the engineering community from the manufacturers saw this as a problem, and Roger, along with others, have helped propel this on to the next level.
That's really good stuff. I mean, and so moving forward, not only will we, a lot of the questions that had come back from your last EVOC podcast and things that were pretty hot topics during the course of the week here at Firehouse World is what can we do to influence or suggest or, you know, short of browbeating our firefighters to get them to use the seat belts. And this most often heard excuse was, well, you know, they just don't work for me. We're going to try to, you know, re-engineer this and create something that's actually going to work for the firefighters. And that's pretty good stuff. All right, next we're going to go on to something that happened about a week and a half, maybe, 10, 11 days ago, up in the city of Boston, where it was reported via the press media and some photos that were pretty rapidly distributed via the Internet regarding a Pierce brand 105-foot rear-mount aerial operated by the Boston Fire Department that had allegedly failed at the scene of a fire where it was rather evident that there's severe structural damage and buckling to the ladder. And Mike, maybe you just want to fill us in as to what actually transpired up there and your assessment as to how that was handled.
Thanks, Tom. The ladder, by being buckled in the middle, you can see where in the picture that the ladder had actually struck the parapet, and of course it's also fixed at the pedestal. Pierce Manufacturing, who's an excellent manufacturer, sent two engineers immediately to the city of Boston to investigate. Their investigation found, and there's also another picture that's being distributed on the Internet, where the control arms for each of the controls up, down, side to side, extend and retract, One of the control arms was damaged to the point where neutral was actually scratched in ink on the control panel, an indelible marker, so that the operator knew where neutral was, so that the apparatus would find a neutral position where it wouldn't be lowered or raised. It was further determined by Pierce engineers that the apparatus had actually been damaged to some degree prior to this incident. It was also reported that there was some paint from perhaps an overhead door that had actually embedded itself into the pedestal controls, and those were damaged. And then that further caused the major damage and what appeared to be a failure. Our hats have to go off to Pierce Manufacturing. They got right on this right away. They did a thorough and complete investigation of the unit and found that there was not any mechanical or any design failure on the part of Pierce Manufacturing at all, but rather previous damage that had been inflicted on the unit by the Boston Fire Department, which then caused this further damage on the unit and caused the unit to malfunction and to buckle. So our hats are off to Pierce. And in another press media report, the Boston fire chief or fire commissioner, I don't recall which, but an official in the Boston Fire Department actually congratulated Pierce as well. And we know now that it had really little to do with it being a Pierce unit, but rather just the circumstances in which the unit was being used.
Yeah, it's again, kind of maybe potentially a sad commentary on not knocking the Boston Fire Department, but the fire service in general, to think that we would allow a piece of equipment that our lives and the lives of citizens that we may be trying to use that aerial device to perform a rescue that was certainly damaged beyond what anyone would consider a minor bump or scrape. And the fact that the inside, as was reported, that the inside of the pedestal, the raise and lowering mechanism actually had been, quote, you know, jerry-rigged so that it would work properly, and there had been physical damage done to the turntable. For that type of damage to be done to the vehicle and not be noted that would have caused the vehicle prior to running an incident where it would have been used, to be taken out of service and inspected at the least by the fire department shops, if not the manufacturer, if the shops were unsure as to what they were looking at, as just kind of leaves me stymied. One of the things that Mike and I were most impressed with during our visit with several of the stations we stopped at San Diego Fire yesterday, that in each piece of apparatus, they have, I'm not sure whether they refer to it as a logbook or the data book for the apparatus, and it has a 5-6 page fact sheet which details all the specific dimensions and the major components on the piece of apparatus, has the requirements for what the engineer has to perform on a daily checkout to run down the apparatus at the beginning of each shift or each tour to ensure that the apparatus is operationally 100% and safe to use, as well as reporting forms that if there is something that is wrong with the vehicle, there's qualifiers of what takes it that it's a minor repair and can be done in the station versus something that would cause the apparatus, such as the ABS light coming on the dashboard to indicate that there's a problem going on that would cause the unit to go out of service after consulting with the battalion chief. So, again, I'm somewhat puzzled here by certainly whichever crew was responsible for damaging the unit initially, to think that by just jerry-rigging the turntable pedestal that would make it okay. But then even more so for whatever shifts came on after the shift to damage it, if they didn't want to fess up as to what the problem was with the vehicle, for each succeeding shift to think it was okay to operate, you know, a fine piece of apparatus that Pierce builds and operate it like that. I'm just, Mike being an engine guy, I know, you know, don't do a lot with the ladders going up in the air, but when they do, the only thing I can say there, again, hats off to Pierce Manufacturing for the way they immediately responded and assessed the situation in no BS manner. And told it like it is, and I guess it's only by the grace of God that no one was injured. Had that unit been extended fully and been operating at a high multi-story, you know, 6 or 8 story building, We are trying to bring brothers up the ladder, or worse yet, bring brothers up to bring civilians down, and that ladder had failed. It certainly could have caused a catastrophic incident that would have been, the outcome would have been much more damaging than what we had there.
Well, and what happens is when the, certainly in our experience, Tom and I, this isn't the first aerial piece that we've seen compromised, and many times apparatus become damaged, and because of policy or punishments or the wrath of the chief, firefighters tend to back it in and not want to fess up. And you can see from this incident that that's just simply not the right thing to do. Better to take the punishment than to buckle the ladder, and ultimately could end up in somebody getting injured or hurt, and even ourselves. So just, I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. The good job that Pierce did, and just the fact that firefighters, when they damage equipment, they need to fess up and be, you know, men and women about it, and come forth, because when the apparatus is compromised in this fashion, it just could impact on fire ground safety all around, and it could have been a real catastrophe, like Tom said. So,
you know, if you look at the fact that our very lives rely upon these pieces of equipment, which are made by human beings and engineered and maintained by human beings, that it's really important for us to take care of our own, and that ladies and gentlemen out there in our listening audience, that starts with every one of you. All right, at the beginning of your tour, if you're in a volunteer department and your regular drill night is Wednesday night, and then drill commences at 1900 hours, the fellow or lady operating that piece of apparatus, if you know you're going to be the chauffeur for that night, you probably want to make sure that rig has been operationally checked out, or at the beginning of the tour of each shift, not simply to just talk to the chauffeur, the engineer that's going off duty, and say, hey, did the rig operate okay yesterday? Sure. Hey, did you fill that paperwork out? Yeah. And just simply take your cup of coffee, the piece of paperwork, go back to the kitchen table, induce another poppy seed bagel into your system, and just simply go down a checklist and check yes, 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 and then go sign it off, because something may have happened, or in this case, again, not to beat up the Boston Fire Department. I'm sure they're fine-run organization, but I'm just incredulous that kind of damage could have been done to the vehicle, and the initial response back was from people as well, the ladder failed. Like some people who are much smarter than myself used to say, when, you know, something happened when you were a little kid, you know, and you broke something, and, you know, you didn't want to fess up, and the adult would normally look at the young child who was somewhat quivering and just saying, well, it just didn't fall down by itself, and that was kind of the situation here. So,
hey, let's talk about Quince. Tom.
Okay, hey, we're live at firehouse.com here in San Diego at Firehouse World, and we'll be back in just a couple minutes.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Okay, we're back here with Mike Wilbur, Tom Shan, and our able technical assistant. We're going to have to come up with a better jargon title than that, Peter Matthews.
Thanks, Pete, for taking care of us, as always.
Yep.
And now can we talk about Quince?
Now we can talk about Quince. Okay, here we go. Just going to kick this off. The other day, one of the classes that Mike and I put on here in San Diego at Firehouse World was talking about ladder company design, and how what you design and what you specify is really going to impact how you operate on the fire ground. And we had a class, 55, 60 folks, and asked for a brief show of hands the number of people that operated Quince. And by far and away, the majority of the hands of the folks represented in the class, a good number of folks from up and down the coast here in California, a couple of brothers from Oregon, and several up from the state of Washington. Let's say consensus was everyone either owned a Quint, and there was a goodly number of people that didn't have a ladder truck at all and were considering when they went into this purchase they were going to go buy one. So got to be a rather lively topic. Now, also the other day, we met some fellows just down on the exhibit floor from the Federal Fire Department here in San Diego, fellows who operated a brand-new Spartan Crimson Quint that's assigned as Ladder Company 7. And we had a nice discussion with them over how they operate with that, because that had been a new piece of apparatus that introduced to the Fed Fire Fleet, where they had previously that unit replaced the Pierce Telescort. So we had some interesting action with those folks. So at any rate, that brings us to after some of these discussions, where I've always been somewhat embroiled into the details and the minutiae, so to speak, of the specifications, and to make sure you buy the right rig. In a lot of cases, from some of the discussions we had from the class, it seemed to be a lot more of the issues were on the operational side. Is like, either, you know, we got it, now what do we do with it? Or, as a couple of fellas mentioned in the class, they were describing the makeup of their community, and while Mike and I are not ER doctors, we can't, you know, tell you from San Diego what kind of fire truck you might need up in Washington, you know, without visiting and actually seeing the structural conditions. A couple folks that were in the process of going to buy some type of aerial device made it evident that the chief or somebody in the administration had already called it a ball or strike and said, we're buying a Quinn, you know, so kind of get used to it. So, Mike, what do you think about that?
Well, I think one of the things that we could recommend to our listening audience, before you enter in to any kind of purchase with any kind of aerial device that can run you anywhere from $400,000 all the way up through $1 million, and you're going to be a first-time purchaser, you really need to think about hiring somebody in, a third party, an objective third party, to come in and perhaps do a needs assessment of your community. You know, do you need a 75-foot Quinn? Do you need a 100-foot ladder? Do you need a tractor-drawn ladder? Do you need a tower ladder or an aerial tower? Does it need to be rear-mounted or mid-mounted? What do your neighbors have? What does ISO recommend for your community as well? What kind of buildings do you have? What kind of target hazards do you have? Travel mileage, staffing levels, all enter into the decision as to whether to buy a Quint or not to buy a Quint. It's not a decision to be taken lightly, and like Tom and I have always said in any of the articles or any of the podcasts that we've done, that you buy this vehicle and it's going to be yours for anywhere from 15 to 20 to 25, in some cases 30 years. And the mistake that you make today may end up costing you for years to come. And so it's a decision that really can't be taken too lightly. And it's always been my experience, and one of the reasons that we have aerial and tower classes to try and teach people how to tactically use this very expensive equipment, is based in the history of aerial devices. Generally, we became motorized in this country in the 20s and 30s, and people would go out and purchase aerial devices. Well, the aerial ladder truck would come into town, and it would be delivered by a person. That person would jump off and point to this switch and that lever and said, this does this, that does that, and have a nice day. And then it was left up to the individual fire departments to really figure out what to do with this piece, how to use it, how to integrate it into their operations. And depending on how many fires the particular piece went to, and how many people got a chance to operate it, and how much training time or drill time was spent with it, kind of and largely depended on how good they would ultimately end up with a device. And you would go over now the next 80 years into this 2007 time frame, and now you get aerial and tower devices that are delivered, and they are delivered by, in many cases, delivery engineers. But the same problems still exist, because 99% of the time, the delivery engineer that delivers a truck has never had an aerial or tower-type truck to the scene of a structural fire. And so although the training is well-intended, and the training is, in most part, really quite good, they're only teaching you about the knobs and the levers and what the truck can do. The reality is that there's a tremendous gap between the end user and what they need to be able to do with the truck, and that new delivery training that just basically tells you how to operate the truck, and there's just no tactical training that's been offered whatsoever, and there's a huge disconnect there.
Mike, it seemed to me that those are issues that we've got just about with every kind of aerial ladder device. The manufacturers, most all the ones that I'm aware of, employ factory, you know, support people that operate from the main manufacturing facility that are trained in the operation of the unit to a large degree. They're trained in the maintenance, and if there were little small hiccups that arose during the course of delivery, these folks can kind of diagnose that and mechanically incline to the point where they can fix it. It seems to me that particularly with Quince, the big issue becomes someone in the fire department, career or volunteer, decides this is the way we're going to go. They buy this vehicle. They go to gets built, delivered. Everybody's happy because they've got a new fire truck. Factory engineer comes in, does the training, and then with the Quint aspect, they're now left, well, they just showed you how to operate the aerial device. What the heck do we do with the rest of this thing? You take a fire department, regardless of size, that traditionally ran some type of conventional aerial ladder device, and now enter, add the pump, tank, and hose, so we now have a full Quint, and nobody's addressed the strategy and tactics that go along with how you're going to go run this thing. And so if you now have engine, Quint, and rescue in your fire station, the debate sometimes even becomes, well, which one of these things do we run out the door first? I mean, is that question sometimes you get asked by people, and is there a right and wrong answer to that?
Well, one of the overwhelming desires of firefighters is to go to fires and put fires out. And so when you have a Quint-type apparatus, and particularly if it's going to be first due, firefighters ultimately get the biggest thrill out of putting the wet stuff on the red stuff. And so the fact of the matter is that the hose lines are going to come off and get strung, and people are going to go in and try to put the fire out. Well, where does that leave the truck work? The ventilation, the entry, the search, the positioning, the proper positioning of the piece to actually operate as an aerial ladder or a tower ladder on the fire ground.
Oh, Mike, I say I'm the officer on this rig, and I come in and I'm first due, and I'm running the Quint, and I see we got fire showing out of two windows on the AB side, and so I know that it's the middle of the night. I'm going to have to force the door. I'm going to have, you know, secure a water supply or hope that the second due engine's behind me. Going to have to go stretch my line. Going to have to do some outside vent. Certainly going to have to do search, but I only got four guys, so if I'm running the Quint, you know, which one of those do you recommend I do first? Or maybe I should have you ride with me, and we'll, you know, you can tell me the right thing to do. I don't want to screw up here.
Well, you can go to a couple sources. Deputy Chief Jimmy Murtaugh from the New York City Fire Department passed the information along, and if you look at Deputy Chief Billy Goldfeder from Loveland Sims, they actually have a firefighting matrix where to really properly operate, even at a smaller building like a 2.5-story frame, you need upwards of 17 firefighters. And one of the points of confusion in this
So I'm going to get a 17-person cab here. That's going to be pretty busy.
That may be what's ultimately going to happen next. We just keep making them bigger and bigger, and we're just trying to do too many things with just one vehicle, and it becomes oversized. And although it may be able to pump and lay hose and put ladders up, ultimately it becomes so big and so cumbersome that they're really not very good for any of those things. It has a lot of stuff, but it's really not good for much of anything when it gets to the fire ground.
There's a really good point. If you can objectively get beyond, again, where I had always thought that the crux of the matter was in the specs and buying the right vehicle to the right size to fit the station and all those other things. If you're tactical operations previously were that you put four guys on a ladder company, all right, and they had no suppression duties. That was taken care of by the engine guys, or in your case, that term that you use all the time would be
the water weasel wagon.
Okay, yeah, all right, the water weasel. I like the wagon part. That comes back to my Maryland roots. The water weasel, I'm not particularly familiar with that. I did visit the San Diego Zoo, and I didn't see any water weasels up there, but I have seen a lot of wagons in San Diego this week. It was pretty good. But to get back to the point of the matter, if you had four firefighters reasonably well trained and their duties were to perform the typical ladder company functions at the scene of the fire, to force the door, some cases as you do in FDNY, to locate the fire to get in ahead of the engine, but just let's say we got to force the door, we got to do a primary search, even on a two-story, you know, dwelling, we got to throw some ladders. Probably going to have to do some outside vent somewhere along the line at some point, control the utilities, and it's always nice to be there for the salvage and overhaul part as well. It's when the real fun begins. That's a lot of stuff for four folks to do. And now if you interject, oh, by the way, we'd like you to try to locate and confine the fire at some point. Now what do you do? It becomes tough doing that with four guys.
It becomes a series of choices. You have X amount of people. You have X amount of jobs to do. What job are you going to do first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth? And, again, firefighters migrate and have the most fun and get the biggest thrill out of stretching hose lines and putting fires out. And so all those other functions that you just listed from ventilation and search and overhaul and some of those other things take a back seat to just fire suppression. And we just don't simply have enough people.
Yeah, one of the other things, the conversations we had with the fellas out here in San Diego from Fed Fire was very insightful to me, where the captain of Ladder 7 was talking about this one incident where they had a major commercial building at one location on a Navy base, and as they recall, Truck 7's first due. So they have to act as an engine company, at least to get the line stretched, but because they also had going to have truck company duties, they had to go force the door and cut some gates and do a whole bunch of other stuff to be able to even get to the point to stretch the line. And in that particular scenario, as was explained to us, they said that one of the issues is it really depends on where you're going and how close that second and third due piece is coming from and the distances. If you're running a Quint and you know that there's an engine that, given the fact that they're responding from the station and not out of position or not out of service or, you know, at the far end of the district, given a normal response time, if you know based on knowing your first due area and where that unit's coming from, you may be able to get away with a few things because you know you're going to have that second and third due company coming with another four or five people basically right up your backside. If your station spacing is such that you know your response district and where you're going, that second and third due company is 5, 6, 7 minutes out, that's another whole ball game, right?
Right, absolutely. And if you remember even just from yesterday when we were with Captain Esther in the city of San Diego here, they have 46, I believe, right, engine companies?
Yeah, I believe it is 46 engines and 12 trucks, which by, you know, quote, our standards back in East Coast where the normal ratio is, you know, like 3-1 or 4-1, that's pretty high out there.
Right, and what would happen in that case is, admittedly so, that the ladder company may be a long way out and that there may be several engines on the scene before we even find ladder service. And then what happens to positioning? That becomes another question.
Yep. Down on the exhibit floor here, down at Firehouse World, it was just kind of interesting that there was several 75-foot rear mount Quints of various sizes, a couple of 105-foot rear mount Quints, and something that I've always taken a strong liking to, and we don't see as many, and they're not quite as popular back east as they are out here. But there were three tractor drones on display. One was a brand new Spartan Crimson aerial that's destined to go to Truck 1 right here in downtown San Diego. Very nicely well-designed unit, and Mike and I climbed all over that, and that will complement the city of San Diego's truck company fleet, which in and of itself to me is a little unique in that of the 12 frontline trucks, they front two tractor-drawn ladders. They have two Quints that are full Quints, although they largely operate, from what I can understand, they operate as ladder companies, but they're like supersized ladders with pumps and tanks and some hose on it. And then everything else in the frontline fleet here in the city of San Diego is a rear mount ladder of some description. But two other units that were on display on the floor were tiller ladders that had pumps and tanks on the tractor. So they're like quillers, ostensibly a Quint. And those jurisdictions, there was one in the American LaFrance booth for San Ramon, California, and then there was one for Los Angeles County in the KME booth that was a pretty neat rig. And in talking to the reps there, that was one of just 10 that the KME is building for LA County on the current order, and then they obviously have many more of those in service. So it does seem what we sometimes joke and refer to the East Coast versus the West Coast Fire Service. But no matter where you are located in this great country of ours, it seems like Quints are certainly the type of vehicle that is becoming most predominant. That in and of itself isn't a bad thing. What it does mean is we need to have our A game on and how we're going to staff these units, but even irrespective of how many people we put on these rigs, we need to have written policies and procedures that explain what you're supposed to do when you get there. You just can't leave it to the discretion of the officer or the proverbial coming from the battalion chief running the call, you know, don't do anything till I get there. So at any rate, that was rather interesting on some of the interactions that we had with the folks here during the course of the week. We've got Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand here with the Apparatus Architects live from San Diego here at Firehouse World. We'll be back in just a minute.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Firehouse World, Apparatus Architect, live from San Diego, California. We have Mike Wilbur
and Tom Shand, and we are glad to be here.
Yeah, much better than the East right now. Just left in a blizzard and glad to be out here in sunny San Diego where the hospitality has been great. And again, would like to thank our producer, Peter Matthews, for sticking around with us here and making this possible. We have learned that the Apparatus Architect now has a sponsor. Task Force Tips has come on board to sponsor us. We are laying the groundwork now where we are going to have at least one show a month. And what we would like from you, our listeners, is for you to submit questions. Down at the bottom of the screen, you will see the address podcasts@firehouse.com where you can submit your questions and they will be read on the air and answered. If you get your questions in before the end of this month, the month of March, your question will be read on the air in April and answered to the best of our abilities. And now we have some questions that I had gotten when I did a webcast in December, an overwhelming amount of questions, over 130 questions, terrific questions that we got and just didn't have time in that forum to answer them all. So we're going to take some of those questions today and answer some of those.
Okay, Mike, first up we have here, with the leading factors to rollover fatalities being commercial cabs or unrestrained occupants, and the majority of fire apparatus crashes being intersection related, why wouldn't there be a benefit for the additional cost to have not only the side airbag protection, but the frontal airbag protection, and why wouldn't that be possible in some of the custom cabs that we use today?
Yes, there'll be an additional cost, and yes, the manufacturing and technology community is working on that as we speak. Right now, the roll protection, as we know it today, are bags that roll down from the roof. They cover the side windows and are there really for just rollover and keep the driver in along with the seat belt and also keep the driver or the passenger from getting road rash or scraping along the pavement's edge. Really not yet designed for side impact, but what manufacturers are doing are using some research and development funds to look into side impact airbags as well as frontal impact airbags. One of the challenges, of course, is the cab of a custom fire truck. On the officer's side, you look at any of the manufacturers and all the equipment that we have here, it may become difficult to try and work through that, and they are to provide an airbag for the officer. And then the driver, you notice the subtle differences between the regular car steering wheel and the steering wheel of an apparatus as far as size and angle of departure from the floor and everything like that. And what's interesting in this is that firefighters see all these safety devices being installed in cars, and right away we leap to, well, why isn't it in the fire truck? And Tom knows better than I as far as the fire truck industry, but just vast differences between a cab of a fire truck and a car.
You know, one of the things with the frontal airbag protection from a technology standpoint, there's nothing that will prohibit you from that technology transfer from a commercial truck into a custom chassis if we could get that same level of standardization from chassis to chassis, particularly with respect if we're talking to frontal airbags with the bumper assembly. If you go to into a firehouse, even in where they have maybe a unit out of the 80s, one out of the 90s, and one that they've purchased in the last couple of years, my guess would be if you brought your trusty 20-foot tape measure and took a measurement from the center line of the front axle to where the front face of the bumper is, the rig in the 80s would be the shorter one, got a little bit longer in the 90s by maybe 6 to 8 inches, and probably the rig that you have now, probably a foot or 18 inches even longer than that. And that's because of two reasons. One, with the predominance of engine forward chassis, and since now virtually all engines are inline six-cylinder diesels, makes the power plant longer front to rear. We need to get more frontal radiator area to cool these, which is certainly going to be the case with the 2007 engines, so the cabs themselves have gotten longer off the front. Then we add to that the pain of if we're just going to be putting a mechanical siren, pair of air horns, and a siren driver in the front bumper. That's one thing. We can stuff all that in 6 to 8 inches. Well, then somebody says, I'd like to have a front suction. Not a problem. Okay, we can maybe have to push the front bumper out to like 14 inches if we're going to use a swivel or do what they do in New York City by running it through the bumper and then scalloping the bumper around it. Well, then enter, you want to have a trash line on a front bumper. That's great. Now we're out to 18 or 20 inches. You get somebody that's running the ever-popular rescue engine. Now they want to put an electric reel or a hydraulic hose reel on the front bumper, and now you're out to 24, 26 inches. There's a unit I'm familiar with where the people wanted to have a booster reel put on the front bumper, right? And now we're out to about 30 inches. Well, since you have this lack of standardization, one of the issues becomes how much crush protection do you have in between the front of the cab and what the bumper is going to be, and will those sensors deploy fast enough based on the reaction time to deploy the airbags before you're actually starting to crush and get into penetration in the bumper. So if we could have more level of standardization in what our rigs look like, that would probably go a long way to be able to help us out.
And isn't there, Tom, a couple other differences, East Coast versus West Coast, as far as the way the apparatus is designed, and also a steel bumper versus something else that the manufacturers come up with?
Yeah, if you even just look at bumper design itself, I mean, the different manufacturers have always had almost a signature look by whether it was an 8-inch or a 12-inch or a 10-inch bumper. And frankly, from a specification standpoint, the thought process in being the way many people think of bigger is better, that, well, geez, a 12-inch bumper's got to give me more protection than an 8-inch bumper. And we're only talking about the height of the bumper. More importantly, what it is what's backing up behind that stainless steel bumper. People refer to it as a chrome bumper. There's very few bumpers out there that are chrome-plated steel anymore. Everything is stainless steel. The city of New York for a number of years has used a steel bumper, painted steel, and the inference was because they were too cheap to afford chrome. They really had a great idea. It's because it was made out of 3/8 steel, basically a channel portion of a frame rail that would provide a lot more of impact resistance if they took on a vehicle or some other immovable object. I know it was just this past week, Mike, there's a ladder company in Queens that got involved with a multi-vehicle hit that wasn't necessarily their fault, but it looks like from some of the pictures I saw, it looks like they took on half the block.
Right. It was actually a ladder in Crown Heights in Brooklyn, ladder 123. Ladder 123 ended up hitting 7 or 8 cars, and in the pictures that are on the web right now, you can see 3 cars actually piled up, a car, another car, and then a minivan on top of each other, and then ladder 123 into those. And what's interesting about that and many other FDNY collisions is that there was little, if any, cab intrusion to the crew. That steel bumper has just shown over and over and over again what a high level of protection that it gives not only to the components and the front of the apparatus, but also to the crew itself.
Yeah, real good point. All right, yes, our next question, and this is one that I've often kind of pondered, but being that I've most of my career have operated in the volunteer service, but it still goes a long way to saying about having somebody that knows what they're doing. And the question was, are there any statistics out there that prove that having a driver's position, in other words, a dedicated position, that means that's going to equal less accidents or hence make you more safe? Fellow follows up by saying, my paid department, which is 600 plus strong, does not have a dedicated driver's position on the job. So are there any statistics, Mike, that would prove that out, or is that one of those wives' tale myths, or what's your thoughts there?
Statistics as far as accidents and apparatus are just extremely difficult to come by. If you recall, Tom, we were at Firehouse Expo a couple years ago, and we actually had a reporter that was doing a story on firefighter fatalities in general and came to us because of firefighter fatalities and emergency vehicle accidents. And the reporter was from USA Today, and he boasted to me that he would get statistics and he would find out, because I told him that there were just no statistics available. The only statistics on accidents come out of the NFPA firefighter fatality program, where we know when a brother or sister is killed in the line of duty as far as an emergency vehicle wreck, but statistics as far as how many emergency vehicle wrecks there are, who was driving, career volunteer, how many civilians were hurt or killed, or how many firefighters were hurt or killed, that information, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, in this age of computers, is just simply not available yet. Nobody is capturing that data. When I sat on a committee for the federal government, where we came up with a report called an Emergency Vehicle Safe Driving Initiative, one of the first recommendations from a very stellar group of industry experts in emergency vehicle driving was for the federal government or FEMA or some agency to come up with a incident system reporting mechanism where it could be downloaded in a computer and we could capture that information. So no, there are no statistics available. But what we do know, just from going around the country doing emergency vehicle training and just the fire service and human nature in general, that a firefighter that is assigned to a company and to drive that company day in and day out has buy-in and really wants to care for the apparatus and becomes just really good at his or her job. It's experience like no other. We know that firefighting is one of the most experience-driven crafts that probably exist on the face of the earth. How do you get good at driving fire trucks? Well, you drive them or you train to drive them to fires. And the more experience like that, by having somebody that's assigned to it, and also just the care and maintenance as far as checking the oils and the overall appearance of the apparatus, we get buy-in from the firefighters that are permanently assigned.
Good thought there, Mike. I mean, if you think about, you know, driving or operating any sophisticated piece of machinery, even in the commercial world, I mean, you wouldn't think of having somebody operate a heavy piece of machinery by just saying, well, yesterday you were moving stock to it, but today we're going to let you operate this neat gizmo and let's just hope you get it right. You know, sometimes the training effort that we put forth needs to be equal to the expectation of how we want the person to perform.
Well, and interesting, I just thought of a good analogy. Your car versus a rental car. You know, how many people really take care of a rental car the same way that they take care of their own personal car, because you have that buy-in?
Well, I didn't tell Hertz, but it's like the little bumper sticker, you know, is on there, drive it like you stole it, you know. Okay, we're going to take a couple more questions here and then wrap up for the day. This one comes in and is real good. What is the age limit for fire trucks when it comes to their age versus their safety features?
Well, why don't you take that one?
You know, NFPA, through the 1901 standard, every subsequent revision has become more and more stringent with a lot of very positive requirements, that the vast majority of which are safety related. Some of them could be accrued to be somewhat technology related as different components come into play. But if you look at a 1990 vintage fire truck that was built and contracted for that didn't have any of the inherent safety features, interlocks, required warning lighting, retroreflective material around the perimeter of the apparatus, and a vehicle that was NFPA 1901 compliant in 1990 versus one that you may have bought even just 3 years later in 1993, it may to the naked eye appear to be the same, but once you get behind the sheet metal, it would be dramatically different. So having said that, if you have a unit in your fleet the majority of your fleet, or hopefully all of your fleet, being that we're in 2007 now, is newer than 1991, you've got a lot of things going for you, particularly with respect to, in Brother Mike's world, an aerial ladder truck, a 1989 or 90 vehicle versus one built 10 years later in 2000. It can have the same kind of paint, same kind of warning lights to a point, and the aerial device may appear to be look the same, but it really does operate a lot differently. So having said that, you have to kind of put things in perspective. If you have a fleet of apparatus, and we'll just play the numbers here so it works out well, you have three engines in a truck, and you'd like your units to last 20 years, you need to be buying a piece of apparatus. It's simple math. You need to buy a fire truck every 5 years. If you haven't done that and they're bunched up, you better hope your revenue stream will enable you to go replace them so that you can get them back on a reasonable life cycle. It seems to be feast or famine. And again, it's very interesting in working with Captain Esther yesterday in San Diego, where he mentioned it in the past, going through the decade of the late 80s into the 90s, they would buy units in groups of typically, I think the smallest group was 5 to 8 at a time, but then there was a 3 or 4 year period where they didn't buy anything. And you would think, geez, that can't be bad. If you're buying 5 or 8 at a time, how bad could it be? But they went from, I believe it was 98 into the early 2001 time frame where they hadn't bought anything. And as he showed us yesterday, they have some units in their fleet with approaching 200,000 miles and a couple of rigs that were over 200,000 miles. Now, that's phenomenal mileage when compared to what you have, you know, in a tightly packed community where you only maybe put 3,000-4,000 miles a year on the rig. But the year that you don't, off year that you don't buy something, not only has maybe technology and safety passed you by, but you're actually wearing out your drivetrain. So you need to kind of have a plan in place. And while there's no hard and fast rule here, one of the watershed items would be if it's a post 1991 rig, you got a lot going for you, and if you had to patch that to keep it along, you'd certainly be much better doing that. And if the unit certainly does not have, a 4-door cab enclosure for sure. If it does not have a current NFPA approved warning light package, you know, if you're still running, you know, your old halogen rotators in a light bar that was circa 1990, you probably have high amp drawers. You have the older style electrical system without load management and load shedding capabilities, and you probably really need to be rethinking that.
I saw this thing, Tom, in a magazine, a couple magazines, trade journals, this Annex D. What does Annex D have to do with all this?
Yep, Annex D was an outline to give you some qualifiers to say, you know, here's what's changed in the world of technology with our apparatus, and if you were thinking of looking at a replacement unit, here are the things that are now in the standard that are required that you should either get those retrofitted to your apparatus if it's physically possible, and if it's not, or it's just beyond financial prudence to throw, $125,000 at a vehicle that you bought 15 years ago and you only paid $200,000 for it, maybe it's time to just put the rig out the pasture, remove it from the fleet and go buy a new unit. So it was, the concept was it was designed to help stimulate the thought process of saying, here are some of all of the safety-related things that need to get integrated that you would get if you bought a modern, current-day piece of apparatus, and sometimes be able to use the ammunition, particularly if the fire department doesn't control their funding stream for apparatus, to have a little, few bullets in the holster, so to speak, of how to go sell it to your municipality. All right, we're going to finish up here with the last question of the day and then wrap up, and once again, we'd like to extend our best wishes to Harvey Eisner for rapid recovery. Want to thank our technical assistant, Peter Matthews, for all of his assistance during the course of the week. And again, just the fine fellowship that we had with the brothers and sisters from the San Diego Fire and Rescue Department. It was just a great time out here. And we'll end up with this one, and we're going to send this one out to Mike, because he was probably on the job just when they introduced this this technical device. What is your opinion on continuing to drive apparatus with manual transmissions? And just to help you, Mike, that was the device that had the little stick shift, and when they finally got rid of the hitched horses, that's what you were doing back in that time, just to kind of put it back in perspective.
Oh, I remember, Tom, that double-clutching son-of-a-gun non-synchromesh transmission where if you missed a gear, you had to stop it and start completely over. Some thoughts on that. We often ask in the EVOC class, automatic transmissions, they became extremely good. Why are automatic transmissions good? Well, the overwhelming answer is that anybody can drive them. And then we ask the question, well, why are automatic transmissions bad? Because anybody can drive them. It used to be in the olden days, Tom, when we had standard transmissions, chances were pretty good that if you didn't know how to shift it or know how to operate it, you probably had no business driving the fire truck. So the standard transmission actually became an eliminator for what could potentially be bad drivers. Now, with the advent of automatic transmissions, that eliminator just isn't so. But on the other hand, we have people now joining the fire service that haven't driven anything bigger than a Toyota Corolla, and the advent of the automatic transmission has actually enabled the fire service to maintain a fair amount of drivers and to be able to move the rigs in a safe and efficient manner, and also keep both hands on the wheels and just create a greater degree of safety in an overall response. The watchword here with transmissions is, no, we don't want to revert back to five-speed double clutch and son of a guns. But on the other hand, with the advent of automatic transmissions and younger people driving that have no heavy-duty truck driving experience, the watchword here is training, and just more training. That's what it's going to take to be able to operate an automatic transmission vehicle safely.
Yeah, just finish up on that comment. Some of the communities that Mike and I have tried to help folks out and consult on spec writing and stuff, it's interesting to see the perspectives within the committee that if there is a person that, by vocation, drove heavy truck, worked maybe for a local hauling company, or drove a concrete mixer, worked for the local town highway department, those people are still very, very familiar with driving and operating a vehicle with a manual transmission. Now, what does that also mean? That person's typically of older generation and had a great deal of experience doing that. And Mike's comment about talking about the proverbial youngster that blows in with their 400 horsepower, personal vehicle that weighs 2,175 pounds, wet when they have the windshield washer solvent bottle filled, and whips into the fire department with his automatic transmission, and then gets behind the wheel of the automatic transmission fire truck that now has that same 400 horsepower engine but a lot more torque. But there's a big difference because now that fire truck weighs 42,000 pounds rather than 2,100 pounds. That the rig handles a lot differently, and it's just having the experience and the respect for the size of the vehicle. And as Mike says, if you don't have enough runs to drive it and to get good at it, what does that mean? That means we've got to just train all the more to be able to do it and to be very, very good at doing it. So,
just a couple of quick reminders to all our listeners. One, our seatbelt initiative. We are still looking for more firefighters to take part and be a part of the seatbelt anthropometric study, the measuring part of getting body scanned. The way that you do that is look at the bottom of your screens, and you'll pick up those websites that you can visit to volunteer and take part. And also, for our next podcast, we would like to answer your question on the air, so please submit your question to podcast@firehouse.com. This is Mike Wilbur.
Tom Shand.
Live from San Diego, California at Firehouse World, bidding you a good afternoon and look forward again to another Apparatus Architect in the near future.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.